Good morning. My name is Parker Wilson, and it's an honor to have been asked to speak today. Something I humbly appreciate. And I always like to begin with a story, so I'll tell you a story. One night out on a desert road, there was a woman driving, and she spied on the side of the road an old Indian woman who looked like she needed a lift, so she slowed down. The old Indian lady got into the car, and she noticed that between her and the driver, there was a bottle of wine. And she looked at the wine, looked at the driver, and looked at the wine again. And the driver noticed this, and she said, "Oh, I got that from my husband." And the Indian lady looked at the wine and the driver again, and then looked back out up the road, and she said, "Good trade." She really liked that. Yeah. So it's always good to, like, you know, I like to open with jokes because it lightens things up a little bit and lets us breathe a little easier. I want to say that the Buddha himself was not a big fan of blind faith. He was very interested in testing things. He was kind of the consummate cognitive psychologist, the consummate scientist. He wouldn't take anybody's word for anything, and he said many times, "Don't believe anything I'm telling you because you think I'm some kind of holy man, or I'm enlightened, or I'm a savior, or a god, or something like that. None of that matters," he said. "You take these things that I'm talking about, you try them. If they're useful for you, you analyze your own experience. If it proves to be something useful for you, you continue to practice. If it doesn't, then you won't. And you'll move on and find something else that's useful for you." I always found that to be a pretty extraordinary opportunity, so, or a statement rather. So I'd like to invite you to have a similar attitude. The Buddha struggled with some central questions. One of them was, what's the problem with life? Why is there so much suffering in things? Why is it that feeling bad and feeling afflicted emotion and just, you know, mental anguish seems like falling off a log for us? It's very easy to accomplish. And happiness and joy and some kind of sense of satisfaction and stability and calm and stillness and peace, these things really take a lot of work. It's like, you know, it's a sustained effort to kind of like try and make these things happen. And even when they do occur, they're very short-lived. They're transient. They're always replaced by another form of suffering somehow. And he wanted to understand why that might be. In our world, it's weird because, you know, we have 90% of the stuff that we think the world wants. All the material that you could ever ask for, most of us have. But despite all of the self-help books and the churches and the synagogues and the seminars and the love affairs and the mistresses and the pills, the money, the new cars, all the houses, all the material we have, we're still not really very happy when you get down to it. He was interested in why that might be. His answer was framed in something he called the Four Noble Truths, two of which we're going to talk about today, the first two. The Buddha discovered that happiness is not some kind of transitory pleasure state or some kind of moment of self-absorbed satisfaction. Now, this is not what happiness is. Most of us think when we get that promotion or we find that right person or we find that right job or what have you, the sensations that go along with that are happiness. The Buddha disagreed. He said they're not true happiness because they fade. They fade away. Therefore, something else must be happiness, if happiness is possible. Something else must be it. But most of us are kind of involved in kind of trying to string together, right, moments of transitory pleasure and self-satisfaction. And we're trying to string them together as tightly as we can to create something that we think of as happiness. The Buddha tried to go a little bit deeper than that. He talked about the fact that happiness is not really, it's not really out there somewhere. It doesn't exist in some soulmate I have somewhere out there that I haven't found, in some perfected job, in some kind of perfected world. it doesn't really live outside of me in any substantial sense. It doesn't really work like that. And even when we deeply realize that, it's still not enough to create happiness for us. We seem to have this sense of anxiety about life. Almost below the surface of everything. It's just a sense of like low-grade anxiety and stress. It's groundlessness. Like the impermanence of everything. It really scares us. We see ourselves in the mirror aging. We see that this world is transitory and shifting and changing, always moving forward. We realize that things cannot stay. And that once something is gone, it is never to return again, not in the exact same way that it was before. This realization terrifies us. And so we seek to tell stories to ourselves about how that might not be true, or it might not be true for us. Maybe I can somehow cordon myself off from the rest of humanity and keep some kind of stability, keep some kind of ground under my feet. And we like to tell stories about that. We use language like always and forever. Things are black or they're white, they're right or they're wrong. Right? We see the world in extremes. But for the Buddha, that's not how the world was. We don't like to talk about it much. We don't even like to admit it to ourselves. But we have that anxiety and that sense of groundlessness. The Buddha thought that to fix a problem, you must really fundamentally understand what the problem is. The first noble truth is that the unenlightened life is suffering. The unenlightened life is suffering. He said it was predictable. He said it was universal in the sense that, no matter who you are, where you are, when you were born, what gender you are, whatever, what color your skin is, what your sexual orientation is, it doesn't really matter. If you're a human being, you will suffer in some pretty predictable ways. Now, before I go into this, check your mood. See if your mood doesn't shift after I've talked about this list. See if you can't see a little list in your mood. Here are the universal sufferings that Buddha talked about. He said we're all born, which is a form of suffering, right? You're born and you're kind of helpless. You are helpless, actually, and all of your needs need to be attended to by someone else, and if they're not, you'll die rather easily, that kind of thing. It's a very dependent place to be, not particularly considered a wonderful state, right? And we're aging, and we're all uncomfortable with age, right? And as we get older, we're susceptible to sickness, which is the next one. We get sick, everything from colds and flus to cancer and AIDS and hepatitis and leukemia and so on. Then he said, we die. Everyone will die. And not only will we die, and that is a certainty, when is unknown to us, and so is how. And we'll also have to watch some people that we love and care about deeply die. And then we'll have to figure out a way to live with that. Then he said that we're met with unfortunate circumstances beyond our control. All of us are. Sometimes you get your heart broken. Sometimes you lose that job that you loved. I could walk out to my car after I'm done here at the Unitarian Church today and be hit by a car. Now, if you would have asked me this morning if I wanted that to happen, like, would you like to be hit by a car this afternoon? I probably would have skipped, you know. I probably would have said, no, I'll pass on that. But it happened anyway, whether I wanted it or not, and now I have to deal with it, right? So unfortunate circumstances. Separation from people, places, and things that we desire, that we want. Some people want to be famous. Some people just want an education. Some people just want to find that person they can share their life with. And circumstances conspire in such a way that it just never occurs. Right? Separations. And then he said everything is impermanent, constantly changing and shifting. In essence, pointing to the fact that there's no ground under our feet. And that really makes us nervous. And then he said there was karma. There is cause and effect in the world. And we don't realize it. We don't get it. We forget that. We forget that every thought, every emotion, every word, every action leaves an imprint, like an energetic imprint on the world around us, and creates the cause for something else energetic to come back to us. We forget that when we get angry, when we become afraid, when we lash out at people. We get aggressive. We forget that. The fact that we forget it and suffer because of it is a suffering. So now most of the time when people hear this, they start getting a little bit depressed. I don't know, maybe you noticed that in yourself, right? It's kind of a, feels like kind of a downer. The fact that that feels like a downer to you, the Buddha would say, is the problem. That's the whole problem, like you're nose to nose with it right now. Right? Is we fundamentally misapprehend reality. We're not seeing things clearly. This is the way things are, the Buddha said, right? All of these things are universal. And if you slow down and you think about it, it's quite logical. You can see that it's true. But in our day-to-day lives, we just disconnect from this truth. And we start seeing things the way, you know, from our compulsivity or impulsivity, our overblown egos, our childhood conditioning and programming and stuff, right? And we go out there and just really make a mess. Right? We disconnect. So to fix a problem, you have to know what the problem is. If you can see suffering as an integral part of human life, like something that cannot be avoided, like there's nothing wrong, okay? Like you're supposed to die. You're supposed to have your heart broken sometimes. You're supposed to get old. You're supposed to get sick. This is the way it rolls, right? I mean, there's no way out. It's unavoidable. If you can accept that, kind of like you accept the fact that you have to breathe and that you have blood in your veins, if you can accept it on a deep level, you can become free. You can liberate yourself if you go deep enough in trying to do it. In fact, one of my teachers said, like, you can, the first time he said this, I thought he was nuts. But he said, you can breathe into no escape. You can just breathe into that feeling of anxiety about, I don't want this to happen to me, all of these things, I don't want it. You can breathe into that. You can relax into it. You can learn to accept it a little more deeply. And once you accept it, you don't have to be so scared of it, right? Because that's where the problem comes in. We get so afraid. And then we start, in our fear, it's like children whistling in the dark. We try to create happy stories, right, about how that's not going to happen to us. And we function on those stories. And it actually ends up making things worse. So the Buddha said we don't see our suffering very clearly. We simply blame ourselves or someone else for our pain. And this kind of starts when we're kids. It's, mom yelled at me. She yelled and screamed, or she was a yeller, right? And that means that I'm a bad kid. That was my attribution. If I were a better kid, mom wouldn't have to yell at me, right? She wouldn't be so angry with me all the time. And dad, he comes home and he smacks me around. That's because my attribution to that is it is for most kids, is, well, it's my fault. Something's going wrong with me, right? It's not that mom is so terrified of her own depression and anxiety that she has to numb out from her own experience of life all the time. She has to drink, right? It's not that dad is just an anger addict who can't tolerate his own feelings of helplessness in this life. And then he has to, like, punish the people, places, and things around him. He has to blame them and get aggressive. It's not that. It's that I have a problem, fundamentally. I'm the problem, right? We continue these mistaken attributions all the way through adulthood. And we don't slow down long enough to realize what was actually happening. Later, when we can't be intimate with a spouse or we can't laugh with our kids because it feels too vulnerable, then again, we blame ourselves for being flawed. Then we get angry. Then we feel guilty again. Like there's something basically wrong with our understanding of the world. We don't know what it is, but we know that we're flawed. So it's not that no one ever modeled this for us, or that almost anyone with the exact same childhood would pretty much have the same challenges as an adult. It's not that. It's that I'm not enough. I'm not good enough. And I'm constantly walking around feeling one down. I'm constantly walking around comparing my insides to other people's outsides, right? Which never goes well for me. Yeah. So the unenlightened life is suffering. In fact, Sigmund Freud, they got at one time this idea of like not being able to tolerate your own emotions. They asked him, he was on a lecture tour in America, and they said, Dr. Freud, what's the point of psychoanalysis? At that time, he went 5 times a week, and it was $200 an hour. And so it was expensive, time-consuming, money-consuming. They said, what's the point of that? Why do people need to do that? And he said, the point of psychoanalysis is to help the person become more tolerant of what was previously intolerable. inside their own mind. So whatever it is, fear, anxiety, loneliness, helplessness, whatever. Whatever it is that you can't tolerate owns you because you don't accept it. Right? You try to run. You try and hit the nearest exit door, right? We can numb out. That's one big exit door. We can use drugs and alcohol to do that. We can use sex to do that. We can use food to do that. Gambling, TV, romance novels, whatever. You can numb out on anything. You can get angry and aggressive. You can take like that sense of anxiety and helplessness and groundlessness and project it onto someone else and blame them for it and become angry. And once you become angry and you have an object of blame, you can get aggressive. It's quite easy to do. Or you can try and buy your way out of it with materialism, right? Just buying all kinds of excessive, extraneous crap you don't really need, just consuming, right? The next thing down the line, right? Or to upgrade your wife, right? The new model of wife, or whatever. New car, right? Or if you can get materialistic with these things. The Buddha thought it might be better if we learned to stay. If instead of always just trying to get out of something, trying to take the nearest exit door, we could somehow learn to stay. If you can stay with what's in your own mind and learn to tolerate it, you might find that it's not as scary as you think it is. You might find that it allows you much more to be able, because you can stay with your own mind, because you can just be present with it, now you can more often and to a higher degree be present with other people's experience too. Without needing to run, right? Without feeling threatened. Without that becoming a scary thing. And that is compassion. That is the essence of compassion. Being able to witness someone else. Being able to connect to them. But if you do the opposite, if you're always running and exiting from your own experience, it eliminates the possibility of compassion. From this position, we're always projecting an exaggerated and artificial reality onto ourselves and the world around us. You can think of a man trying to buy a Jaguar. Let's say he really loves this Jaguar, and so he saves up for 6 months, takes an extra job, gets the money together, right? And then he goes down to the dealership and leases it, and as he's driving it off the lot, brand new Jaguar, he's just high. It's wonderful. He calls up his family and friends. Everybody wants to see it, right? They want to ride in it. So he's got to like drive it over there and take everybody for a ride, and it's really great. And the girls on the street are looking at him, right? And everybody's turning their head to see it. He doesn't even have the plates on it yet, right? Maybe he left the sticker up, just for a little extra impression. Now, 6 months later, however, it's okay. I mean, it's good. The Jaguar is still a Jaguar and everything, but somehow it's worn off a little bit. His family and friends are over it. Everyone's seen it. They've had a ride in it. They get it. And, his emotions about it have decreased somehow. Doesn't really know why. The next models are about to come out. And, okay. Fast forward another year. Now he's broken down on the side of the I-25 with a flat tire. And he's late for a meeting. Okay. And it's a snowstorm. And now he gets out of his car, and the car is just a piece of junk. It's just crap, right? And he kicks the thing and curses it. How does this happen? Right? This is what happens to us. Am I lying? Right? Okay, so the Buddha said it's instructive to ask yourself what's changed here. Did the car fundamentally change in any real, substantial way? Not really. It's still the same basic machine it was the day he bought it. A few scratches and dings and a flat tire aside. It's still the same basic car. The man's emotions about the car, however, have gone on extreme highs and lows. Extreme highs and lows. The Buddha said this happens because we tend to superimpose onto people, places, and things around us qualities and characteristics that they do not possess. And then we believe with the full force of our mind that they do possess these things. Right? So, maybe this guy who bought the Jaguar, maybe for him the Jaguar was prestige, wealth, sexiness. Right? Almost as if prestige and wealth and sexiness were like mixed into the steel of the Jaguar, as if they were like inherent characteristics of the vehicle. And then he believed that this was so, right? He expected it to be so. Expectations. Strong expectations. So when the impermanent nature of reality and the groundlessness of reality met head on with his exaggerated superimpositions and expectations, his mind was shattered. Right? He became dissatisfied. And then eventually he became angry and lashed out. The Buddha said this is fundamentally what's going on with us. We do this with people. We do this with ourselves. We do this with things around us, places. This is what we do, and it's the engine of suffering. So he said, what if you could just stop all this? What if we could recognize on a really deep level that we're hurting and anxious and confused? Samsara, he said, samsara is like the cycle of birth and death. Samsara is nothing more than confused existence, the Buddha said. And therefore, nirvana is nothing other than the lifting of that confusion and being able to see things clearly, like with a little more clarity and a little more stillness. What if we could just see that we do not see very clearly? Like Socrates, I know enough to know that I don't know really anything. Right? What if we could see that we're not seeing things clearly? What if we could at least have that realization? One of my teachers called that the beginning of the beginning of the path, right? You fundamentally just recognize that, oh, yeah, I see I'm not seeing clearly. I don't know much more than that, but I see that at least. What if we could learn to catch all our exaggerated stories that end up just fueling the fire of anxiety and hostility? Well, how do you do something like that? Well, that's where mindfulness comes into the picture. Mindfulness is this idea of being present with your mental phenomena. What are mental phenomena? They are thinking, so feeling, judging, having opinions, beliefs, perceptions, images, fantasies, memories, all of these things that are in the domain of the mind. Okay? Mental phenomena. It's like learning to be present with mental phenomena without needing to add or subtract anything to them. Learning to be present with mental phenomena and just learning to stay. Learning to be present with whatever is there. Without buying into your judgments and your stories about what's there and what that means about you or that person across the hallway or whatever, right? You don't need to go to all these places. You can just notice. You can just notice what's happening in your own mind and make a commitment to be more present with it without needing to do something about it. Right? So, mindfulness is the ability to be present with your own mind without adding or subtracting anything. It's this ability to stay. There's nothing wrong with suffering. It's built into the deal here. It's just a part of what we do. It's a part of what happens to us. There's no escape from it, like there's no way out. So the Buddha's idea was just to like wise up and learn to enjoy it. Like the Buddha didn't like obliterate himself in some kind of existential sense. Right? He's not out of existence or in some place called nirvana, right? I mean, he kind of like exploded everywhere. I mean, there's no difference, right, between samsara and nirvana. At the end of the day, if you slow down long enough and look at it closely enough. So suffering, then, can be the gateway to the path. Truly waking up starts by becoming aware, like on a very deep level, of how we suffer. The first noble truth is a statement of the problem. How do we suffer? The second noble truth is a statement of why. And that gets into attachment. Attachment. After that, we might become courageous enough to stay with the experience of suffering itself. We learn to stop running and shutting down and numbing out and blaming others and becoming angry and aggressive and trying to buy our way into some kind of happiness. And we learn to just put the brakes on all of that stuff. Maybe just for a second. And we learn to just kind of stay present with what's actually going on in our own mind, right? Like that song was talking about, you know, you don't grasp onto the past or predict the future, right? You're not clinging either way. You're right here, which is all you really have anyway. What's going on right now? Right? The past is dead and the future doesn't exist and it might not ever exist. So, staying. There are many metaphors for this kind of staying, like learning to be present with your own mind. Some call it sitting in the fire. Some call it facing the demon, smiling at fear, going to the places that scare you, leaning into the edge, and there are many more. But they all point to like this fundamental wisdom that on a very basic level, it's not a great idea to split off from your own experience of life into all kinds of stuff that you're making up. That's probably not going to work out really well. On a fundamental level, it's probably better just to learn to stay with what's actually going on in your mind. Because if you can do that, you'll learn it's not so scary. And if you learn it's not so scary, you'll start to accept it. And if you start to accept it, you can start to work with it. You can start to transform it. From this position, compassion, true compassion, begins. When you can become more tolerant and comfortable with your own thoughts and emotions, you no longer feel so compelled to run away. You no longer feel so compelled to make somebody wrong and to make somebody right. The world stops existing in extremes. Things are not so black and white anymore, and thank God. It starts becoming deeper. It starts becoming more profound. Now you can be authentically present with yourself and others in a way not possible before you began cultivating mindfulness. It shifts everything. It changes your perspective, your orientation on life. Now your heart is actually involved and connected, both to your own experience of life and to the experience of the world around you. This is compassion. And compassion is healing. I'm not sure why. Even as a doctor of clinical psychology, I don't know why. But it is healing. There's a story from the Buddha's time about a woman who lost her child in its infancy. And she was in tremendous grief, as mothers who lose children are. I've never seen greater grief, actually. And she was so stuck in her grief that she was carrying around the corpse of the infant, right, for days afterwards and refused to release it. And her family saw she was losing her grip. And there was a teacher coming through the village, you know, some wandering mendicant of which they had thousands, who said he was a holy man or something during those days, right? And they said, this new teacher is coming through, and why don't you... She was talking about killing herself. And they said, go talk to this teacher before you kill yourself, okay, please. So she agreed, like, yeah, whatever. So she went, and it was the Buddha, right? But he wasn't, like, the big deal that he is today. He was just another teacher, right, wandering through a village. So she sat down, and she said, if you've got some way out of grief, if you've got some way for me to work with this, then you'd better tell me, because if you don't have a way, I'm gone, I'm outie 5,000. I'm done. So he said, I do have a way out of grief, but you have to do something for me first. You have to go around to every house in this village, and if you can't find it in this village, you have to go to the next one and the next one and the next one. But I need one mustard seed. I don't know what it is about mustard seeds. All these guys love the mustard seeds. He said, I need one mustard seed from a house that has never experienced death. When you can bring me one mustard seed from a house that has never experienced death, then I will give you the magical, special secret out of grief. So she went away. She agreed, and she went away. She was gone for 3 years. And the Buddha had, of course, moved on to some other region of India and some other village. And one day she found him again, and she came up to him, and she sat down next to him, and she smiled from pure joy and began crying at his feet. So it's interesting to ask, who healed this woman? The Buddha? I doubt it. Probably it was going around door to door, knocking on doors, asking if anyone else had experienced death, and she found how many mothers who had lost a child, and she talked to them, and it opened her heart. She knew that she wasn't alone, that she was in the same boat with a lot of people. She knew that the universe wasn't personally attacking her. It wasn't like that. That suffering was just built into the deal. She learned that you can transcend the suffering, that you can make it meaningful, This is how we turn suffering into the path. This is how suffering becomes compassion, kindness, patience, generosity. Even the generosity of just being present with someone else. Being present with your own mind, perhaps you could be that generous with yourself, rather than seeking to exit. When we become still, open, and willing to stay, we begin to see opportunities that never would have occurred to us. When our minds slow down and become less anxious and fragmented, we can truly become peaceful and skillful. We can learn to transform difficulty into compassion. Compassion and joy really do walk hand in hand. When you cease being so afraid of your own experience, then you no longer need to exit. You're no longer afraid of the experience. And you're no longer afraid of other people. You lighten up a little bit. You learn to laugh. You learn how to help other people lighten up and open their hearts a little bit. Slow down a little bit. Be more present with their own experience. This increases the compassion in the world. Suffering actually becomes the path in Buddhism. But in the beginning, it's good for really rubbing your nose in it, right? And it doesn't feel particularly comfortable. But the end result is good. We can cease being slaves to I like and I dislike and I want and I don't want and all of our judgments and the stories that we tell about the world and about ourselves. We can cease being so slavish to that. We can learn to transcend those stories, those labels, and those beliefs. We can learn to live beyond them. We can even learn to live beyond the concepts of life and death. And what would this world become if more of us learned to live this way? At that point, I think samsara and nirvana would be totally indistinguishable. And perhaps at the end of the day, that's a reasonable definition for enlightenment, a reasonable definition for happiness. Thank you.